The last 40 years have seen a wonderful advances in the sexual liberation of men in this country. Generally in the advanced urban industrial world, and because of the power and ubiquity of the West's opinion-forming media of morality, information and entertainment, increasingly in the world at large, men have been sexually liberated. Sexual intercourse for the female is in all bisexual species and in all human social systems more consequential for the woman than it is for the male. The female carries the child, gives birth to the child, and among mammals is equipped to suckle the child, though the feeding bottle has reduced the importance of this last biological characteristic of the human female. By the way, I apologise in advance for my style, and you may think it's very peculiar that I should say that about birth and so forth, somebody saying, well, that's obvious. When I've been asked by the media very frequently in the past, I've said, well, ask Fred next door. I'm only saying what Fred next door knows. That, to go to the chairman's point, I remember once coming back from a meeting in London, and I was talking to one of my pals down the beach, an ex-miner, and he says, well, where have you been, Norman? And I said, I've been to, what have you been talking about? I said, well, I've been saying that the lone parent family produces more problems on the average than the two-parent family. And he says, it needs a professor to say that. And I said, well, Val, the tragedy is, this is the chairman's point, the tragedy is that it needs a professor to say the opposite. The health of the human mother can be influenced by her pregnancy. Historically, human childbirth has been for the mother a major matter of life and death, and in many parts of the world still is. Nature has provided the man with the biological incentive to have sexual intercourse, but no biological incentive, or at best very little biological incentive, to bear the burdens of parenthood and, in civilized terms, of spousehood. If the man is to make a long-term contribution to providing love, protection, nurture, and training for his child, then nearly all the work must be done by socialization and social control, by the culture through which sociological fathers, as distinct from mere biological fathers, are produced. Sex without these kinds of responsibilities is naturally the mainly unrealized fantasy of human males, excepting in a company like this, of course. And it has been available to the very rich and the very powerful in many societies. We all know that John F. Kennedy not only had the book he had been reading in Washington open on the same page on the table of his hotel room when he reached New York, rich and powerful man, but that his hotel had a tunnel to neighboring hotels where he could keep his trysts without having to brave the waiting press in the lobby. We all know that King Solomon loved many strange women, together with the daughters of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonites, and Hittites. Then there were his 700 wives and so forth. Up to 30 or 40 years ago in this country, these privileges were denied to ordinary men. Possible sexual activities were closely monitored by nearly every adult who came into contact with a mature couple. The intention was to ensure that as far as possible, before a man had sexual intercourse with a woman, he should undertake far-reaching, long-lasting, and wide-ranging commitments to his possible child and the mother of his possible child. It was not until the Lambeth Conference of 1930 that the bishops of the Church of England accepted that there could be a morally sound reason for practicing sexual intercourse within marriage when it could not lead to a child being conceived. So sexual intercourse was all about children, about marriage. I'll put a slide on. If you look at the advanced countries and the backward countries in the European Union now, you'll see what has happened really with modernity, with progress. If you look at the EC, European Union, European Community it's now called, has these social surveys called the Eurobarometer. And in 1990, they looked especially at families, and one of the questions that was explored, and that's the summary of it, what are families for? And 69% of the people interviewed in Portugal said it was about bringing up and educating children. In Greece, 63%, Spain, 60%, you can see the figure there. Right down at the bottom is the United Kingdom, where whatever the meaning of the question was, it was taken by Portugal to mean it's about children. In this country, however it was taken, 25% only thought it was mainly to bring up and educate children. And what are families for? The other side of it, is it about personal fulfillment and affection between the parties and so forth, mainly to provide affection? And you see the thing is reversed. And 42% of the families in the United Kingdom by 1990 saying that families are about affection. Binding obligations concerning procreation, child care, child rearing, and the type of care of adults for one another that cannot be replaced from either professional or commercial sources were required from the man within the social institution of the formal marriage. With increasing success and speed, that control has been shaken off. The man's duties towards his children and the mother of his children have been privatized, made into his own, from being a public affair in three ways. Firstly, there has been an increase in the freedom for fathers, as of course there has been for mothers. I'm concentrating on the effect for men here. There's been an increase in the freedom from fathers, as there has been for mothers, to leave their spouse, and for fathers to leave or to lose their children. Legal changes, as always, were much less important than changes in public opinion. The law reached and reaches only a few crude externals of the immensely complicated, dense and fine-meshed web of British society's rules, expectations and practices touching on sexual and child-rearing conduct. These rules ranged in those days from the ban on adultery to what was permitted in seemly language to the scarcely perceptible gesture in a given situation. The rules were discussed and enforced with variations in Pall Mall clubs and Pitman's coit games, in bourgeois suburb, corner shop and football matches. There was a ban in football matches, in swearing in the presence of women, for example. But changes in the law track and can stimulate usually unpredicted and often undesired changes in the complex and subtle, for all practical purposes, infinitely complex and subtle, social fabric of the time. Up to the middle of the 19th century, legal divorce was almost unknown in England, a matter of 2-3 a year for centuries. The divorce rate did not exceed 1,000 until 1914. So, now, in 1878, the Magistrates Act permitted separation on the basis which became the basis for divorce, not until 1936, not until the Herbert Act of 1936. So this idea that it depended only on changes in the law is, you can only arrive at that conclusion by completely ignoring the Magistrate Courts Act of 1878, because with that act, separations also ran at a very low rate. Divorce rate did not exceed 10,000 until 1942. That meant that nobody's saying that people loved one another. But it meant that the vast majority of British adults lived under the same roof. They found some modus vivendi to live under the same roof, and they behaved themselves to one another and in the presence of other people in such a way that enabled that to be a feasible way of life. For 20 years from 1961, the speed of this social change has been dramatic. In 1961, 32,000 new petitions were filed. In 1971, the figure was 110,000. In 1990, nearly 200,000, 192,000. From being the country with one of the lowest rates of divorce in Europe, among those with laws that permitted divorce, England became the country with the highest. In 1971, the first year of the operation of the Divorce Reform Act 1979, well over 100 new petitions were filed. A high proportion of them, however, concerning the relatively unimportant social category of childless couples. Now there are well over 100,000 divorces a year where there are one or more children in the family. This is the volume and the rate of change is really quite astonishing in sociological terms. Socialization and social control, far more important than the law, were constantly losing their power to produce, and even the intention of producing, effective and successfully committed fathers. That is, people that in fact could live with another person for a lifetime, having those attitudes and those ways of... I remember when I was young, and I was a young graduate, and I was very much into the Freudian business. I was on the Bristol Social Project, and I'd been married a couple of years, and I used to discuss everything with my wife, and my wife used to say, least said, soonest mended. Least, a great... if we're having an argument and you feel so aggrieved that you won't speak to me again ever, it'll probably be over in 20 minutes. If you have an argument and you want to kill me, it'll be over by the end of the day, right? So least said, soonest mended. And all kinds of ways of course, in the working class, by and large, it was regarded as a sign of lamentable immaturity if people talked about romance when they'd been married a few years. They had to get down to the serious business of living together and really, by and large, the men sort of their own affairs and the women sort of their own affairs. But it's got nothing to do with any fair or unfair division of labour, by the way. I've spent a long time with people that have, to me, very peculiar ideas, and seem to think that the division of labour was terribly unfair before the war, that the women were slaving away at the post-up, while the men were lounging about at sea or lounging about down the pit or something. So that's the first change. I don't think the law is all that important, that society decided that if you didn't like the person you were living with, then you didn't live with that person. And divorce rates only levelled out because a second and even more fundamental change took place. There was a marked growth in the number and proportion of couples who no longer regarded their private project, what they now regard as their private project, of living together as requiring the formality even of the marriage that was nobody's business but their own. The man was less and less required by the woman or anyone else in his social circles to make a binding commitment to the possible mother of his children before he could have, without public censure and other penalties, regular sexual intercourse with her in a common household. This trend started with the cohabitation of couples who eventually married one another. There was a survey carried out in 1986-87 of married women who were asked whether they had cohabited with a man who was to become the husband of their first marriage. Married women were asked. Of those married in 1966, that is, those that had been married about 20 years, only 2% had cohabited before marriage. The proportion had tripled among the women marrying in 1971 to 7%. It nearly tripled again by 1976 to 19%. By the end of the 80s, cohabitation before marriage had become almost as common as not cohabiting before marriage. For all marriages, and not just first marriages, it had become commoner. And among married men, much commoner, 58%. And by the 1990s, partner was the normal term by which the most staid organisations addressed even husbands and wives. The 1960s hope that trial marriages, that cohabitation, would be the basis of greater stability when marriage was finally undertaken, has not been borne out by the facts. Marriages after cohabitation are more likely to end in divorce than marriages without prior cohabitation. Cohabitation is much more likely to end in lone parenthood than is marriage. The third change concerns something more than just two adults living together, namely the domestic circumstances under which children would be born and brought up, and it concerned especially the degree of certainty that any child, any unborn child that is, could have that its father would be permanently committed to looking after it. During the first half of this century, the percentage of births where the father had not committed himself by marriage remained at about 4 or 5%. In fact, it had dropped during the 19th century. You know that births, marriages and deaths began to be registered in 1836. So we have good figures on this very public thing of a girl walking about for several weeks, most of them quite obviously going to have a baby, and the authorities and the public know what was going to happen to that baby. I seem not to have put it in, sorry. Anyway, I'm giving you the figures. Illegitimacy, as it used to be called, of course it's no longer illegal, or the term, that illegitimacy ceased to be a category of any official meaning in 1986. But what used to be called illegitimacy, and for brevity I'll call it illegitimacy, fell in the 19th century to about 4 or 5%. Now, as in any figures in social science, there's a margin for error here. At the beginning of the 20th century, a mother would go away and come back with the daughter and claim the baby for her own, or whatever. So there was some conceit, so there was this effort to have the baby registered as being legitimate in one way or another. But that figure remained at about 4 or 5% for a good part of this century. It was raised to 6% during the Great War and to 9% during the Second World War. But it dropped to about 5% again in the early 1950s. That's, of course, without benefit of the birth pill. So, with the birth pill and with the universal knowledge of the condom and so forth, there's something really remarkable happened to the fornication conception ratio. In 1971, a lot of the changes happened quite rapidly, but actual legitimacy increased somewhat less rapidly. By 1971, it was 8%. of all live births were born outside of marriage. By 1981, in present-day terms, you can say it was still only 13%. But in the 1980s, children were born with ever-increasing frequency outside of marriage, accounting today for well over 30% of all births. And for the first time in 1991, in the category of lone mother, of lone parent, but mainly mothers, in the category of lone mothers, for the first time in 1990, the biggest category that was being created was the never married mother. Before it had been separated mothers and divorced mothers and so forth. In 1961, where the mothers were under the age of 20, about 50,000 of the children had been born in marriage, and about 10,000 out, the figures actually were 53,000 and 13,000. Today, those figures are just about reversed. About 10,000 being born within marriage, about 50,000 outside of marriage. A marker for the sexual liberation of men, and how far it is nowadays taken for granted, is provided by the Archbishop of Canterbury's, my apologies to anyone here who thinks this is an inappropriate remark, I happen just to be a social scientist.
<Go ahead.
laughs> A marker for the sexual liberation of men, and how far it is nowadays taken for granted, is provided by the Archbishop of Canterbury's speech in the House of Lords late last year. Warning against the sin of self-righteousness, he pointed out that Solomon himself had got through all those princesses and all of those concubines, not counting the rest. And the implication of his remark could only be this: we should not therefore get too excited if from time to time some royal personage doesn't quite manage to live up to the sacred vows of marriage for very long. Or if this or that minister of the crown in Westminster has got through one or two mistresses. Or if this or that minister of the cloth has got through two or three wives in Norfolk. It is true that when challenged, the Archbishop protested that he was against sin. Well, that's not the funny line, that isn't. He says it was against sin, so-called sin. That's what he said. The qualification probably goes a long way to explain the fact that when the Bishop of Norwich decided that after two divorces and the intention to marry the woman he was cohabiting with, the vicar in question could in no way bear witness effectively to Christian standards of marriage, when the Bishop of Norwich tried to apply that principle, some church wardens were shocked to the core by this eccentric doctrine of lifelong monogamy. To calls and shouts, they and a third of the congregation stormed out of the bishop's service, the uproar being partly drowned by the sound of the church organ. The organist is now on holiday, and some parishioners believe that she has resigned. Yet in Solomon's case, though he was let off this time, out of consideration for his father David, and no doubt let off out of unconditional love and forgiveness, God was certainly angry. For Solomon went whoring after false gods of his partners, just as God said he would. He whored after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and whored after other loathsome and strange gods, and built a high place to Molech, the abomination of the children of Ammon, and so on and so forth. And God said quite clearly to Solomon that he really had better let a little self-righteousness creep in and set a better example. Otherwise, God would surely rend his kingdom from him, and so forth, which seems to me to be on strictly sociological grounds a sounder and more realistic message on the whole than the Archbishop of Canterbury's. Views about marriage and the family are very mixed in Christian churches. Most books on the family that sell well to Christians are still largely and strongly pro-family. The important point is that those few interested people who have had a pronounced and urgent opinion on marriage, most people not having a pronounced and urgent opinion on marriage because they're taken for granted. And in the 1960s, all the reforms, and I don't challenge, but I'd like to see anybody bring me some part of discussion in the 1960s by the Law Commission or by the Commission on Putting Asunder or speeches in Parliament that didn't take for granted that the family was all right. That the Abortion Act, for example, would simply bring, was just a remnant of the old non-contraceptive system and of ignorance and people not treating it in an everyday fashion. And the few remnants of that system would be brought into the hospitals instead of being dealt with in the back streets. But the few people who've had a pronounced and urgent opinion on marriage and the family, and in the past few years have sought to press their case, and have come to be regarded as the people to be taken seriously and consulted, have been overwhelmingly antagonistic to the special honour accorded, second only to celibacy and virginity, to heterosexual relationships within the context of lifelong monogamy. Leaving to one side moral philosophy, still more the endlessly inventive hermeneutics of postmodernist theology, the empirically quantifiable results on children through cohabitative and lone parenting on the one hand, and on the general body of citizens through the rise in criminality among young men on the other, are now beyond all denial. It is a theological statement that Jesus was opposed to family life, and that he instructed us to hate our fathers, and hate our mothers, and hate our husbands, and hate our wives, and leave them all. It's a theological statement. It's a theological statement that there are no marriages in heaven, and therefore the further away we get from the awful exclusivity of the nuclear family, the nearer we are to realizing the kingdom of God on earth. Those are theological statements. If it is true that we're all the products of our genes and successive life circumstances, then it is a moral statement that no one can be blamed for what he does. He cannot be morally condemned for being one of the beautiful and terrifying boys, beloved of the New Musical Express, or for screwing the state through the housing and social security system, or for publicising 81 ways to trash you a school. By the same theory of human nature and the same morality deduced from it, of course, he cannot be blamed for beating the burglar up, or inefficiently and fraudulently screwing up the social security system itself so the benefits are not paid on time or at all, or for publicising 81 ways to trash the pupil arsonist. It is a moral statement that we have no way of saying that being a competent reader is better than being a poor reader. But it is an empirical statement that people are less willing to commit themselves to a lifelong marriage than they were in the 1950s. That people with the same level of difficulty in their marriages are much more likely to divorce than they were in the 1950s. That the average child brought up by both its married parents, the legitimate child brought up by both its married parents, scores more highly than the average child from the rapidly and greatly increased proportion of lone parent households with the same income and at the same social class on a wide range of measures that nearly all parents concretely want their children to score more highly on, if possible. On average, the legitimate child brought up by its married parents has higher chances than other children, except very often adopted children, of surviving, of not dying by the time he's one, and not dying by the time it's five, of not being subject to accidents at home, or not being physically and sexually abused, of scoring more highly on measures of academic competence, of staying out of the hands of the law. It is not certain, but it is not unlikely, that this autumn the Church of England will grant some sort of sacerdotal approval to cohabitation. The equivalence between cohabitation and marriage is now so deeply seated in everyday consciousness that when David Winter, on Thursday I think it was, in Radio 4's Thought for the Day, wanted to do an apt illustration of misplaced loyalty, he gave protecting a husband who was battling his children. Protecting a husband who was... So partner isn't always used. When it's used against the family, we're certainly talking about husbands. The family is now widely used, and was indeed so officially defined by the UN in the UN Year of the Family, to cover any domestic arrangement whatsoever of any single adult or any number of consenting adults living together and taking some responsibility for children. From 1983 onwards, the form that had to be completed by the worker on the case for entry on the child protection registers maintained by the NSPCC lumped together married and cohabiting natural parents. We only have the category of natural parents. Unfortunately for them, the equivalence between cohabitation and marriage that theologians whose expertise is child abuse in the family are sufficiently or insufficiently inquisitive or careful about, and that the NSPCC record-taking apparently takes for granted, that that equivalence does not apply to the children. As Robert Whelan showed from his survey of cases of child abuse and risk of abuse in the Family Court Reporter Survey, it was 20 times more risky to be a child if both its natural parents were only cohabiting than if both its natural parents were married. If we take the 35 cases of undoubted abuse, and that is being battered to death in the last few years, where details are known from public inquiries into the deaths of the children, the child was 18 times more likely to be killed by one of its two cohabiting natural parents than by one of its married natural parents. It was 74 times more dangerous if it was the unmarried mother and the cohabiting boyfriend. The family of the legitimate child and its own married parents is superior on measures of personal safety from abuse, but the ambiguity of the term now means that what is detrimentally true of families in the sense of alternative families is by a linguistic sleight of hand attributed to the married family of the legitimate child. It is on these occasions that the usual practice of calling husbands and wives partners is reversed, and partners are referred to as if they were husbands and wives. The evils that stem from the absence of marriage and legitimacy are thus sloppily but damagingly and effectively attributed to the existence of marriage and the family. The astonishing thing is that there are hardly any studies that do not show this pattern of superior result from married parents and their legitimate children. There are either no studies at all, or they are so rare and lost in obscure archives as to have never been either discovered by me or my colleagues that I'm working with, or brought to our attention in controversy. In examining the range of research on the subject, we assiduously asked our colleagues, who have this other opinion that the family is not deteriorating, it's only changing, well, where is the evidence? And quite frequently at the beginning, we were directed by optimistic colleagues to studies which did indeed show married families, legitimate children, doing badly as compared with children from other backgrounds. But that is simply a matter of the overlap of two distributions, which nobody's right mind, there's no friend next door doesn't think that there's not bad married families and there's not good, wonderful single parent families. That's the pattern that you always find. You've got the low score and the high score. You've got a mean score and a distribution about the mean scores. And one group, in this case, the married family, does better on the average than its alternatives. And of course, there's all of these in the married families that do worse than all of these in the unmarried families, but they say there's no difference, or they say that if more and more children are shifting into this distribution, there's no problem, is intellectual laxity, isn't it? It's exactly the same argument as saying that that men are the same size as women because some women are taller than some men. It is exactly the same argument. It's astonishing. I'm quite convinced that in 30 or 40 years' time, when we look back at this free run that people had for 30 years in this country, that people will not be able to believe it. It'll be like people be talking about it like medieval dance manias. On one occasion, I personally had gone down and given a paper. I'd been met with the most extreme hostility. And over lunch, this deputy director of a very, very eminent research foundation, and I said, well, where are... She says, you know... He snapped at me. She says, Spanish. She says, you know quite well, there are no such studies. I said, well, what's going on? I mean, what's the argument about them? Well, you see, this is damaging to the interests of these poor girls that need more money and so forth. You must say that kind of thing. That you're hard-hearted. So that you're hard-hearted if you say, well, let's have a system that doesn't create and multiply the problem by solving the problem in a particular way in a pastoral manner now. Of course, there's the question of what is pastoral and the question of what is social and sociological, and the task of the theologian is to take the wide view and the large view and the long view and ask, well, what's the final result? What is going to be beneficial for most people most of the time? And not keep creating the problem and exacerbating the problem by treating people in inappropriate ways, pastorally. And there's another strange feature of these debates. In physical matters, inconclusive evidence, which if valid would indicate great dangers, is taken extremely seriously. So some of the people that I argue with about the family, I might go to lunch with them and they wouldn't wrap up a pork chop in a piece of plastic film in case it gave them cancer or something. They'll take all these kind of things extremely seriously, right? And they also take the potentially large consequences of small disruption to ecological systems. Fully recognised. There's an entirely different approach to social ecology. Quite obvious and gross changes for the worse have occurred in parts of the social system, and there are strong indications from both empirical studies and on theoretical grounds. What's the time anyway? I forgot to put the time elapsed on. Been waiting for the peep. I thought it might be about an hour and a half gone by. Instead of alarm, there is complacency. Even to the extent of saying, crime hasn't increased. It's all moral panic. So all of this tremendous increase in insurance premiums, I'm going away to Florida tonight. If I got back and I find I'm not being burgled, I think that's, you know, a great bonus. And all of these shutters that have gone up in all the shops in the last few years, all complete waste of money that everybody's just imagining it. Hmm? Well, you've seen this. I mean, it's kind of tell you that it's absolutely rampant in sociology. So I'll waste some time. I'll tell you that I was once going down to London, and a friend of mine said, you know, you shouldn't be saying that, Norman, about this crime. You know, it's all moral panic. And he says, look at this book here. He said, Geoffrey Pearson's Hooligan. He says, I don't show people from Newcastle in London. You know, not the big city. He says, so I picked up Hooligan, and there was this Pearson's, this is Professor Pearson, and paperback, said book in the Open University, and Pearson is proving conclusively it's all moral panic, that there's just as much crime before the war, and indeed, wherever you want to look, it's just as much, it's always just people in moral panic. And to prove it, he says, well, street crime is a really crucial test. People are more sensitive about street crime. And he says, between 1925 and 1928, bag snatching increased by 92% in London, and other street crimes increased by 124%. So it's not a difficult job. I mean, I'm in the university, there's a library there. So I thought, well, that's funny. So I just went to the library, perfectly easy thing to check upon, by the way, just the, right? And the passage, the passage says, now that people have motor cars, they're not doing the dangerous thing of robbing people in the town, they're going out in the country and robbing country houses. There's only very few that engage in the daring business of bag snatching, right? And so on and so forth. In other words, the whole tenor is against what Pearson is saying in the book. And I came back and I said to my friend, I said, well, how many bag snatchers do you think there were in London in the Metropolitan Police District in 1925? And he says, well, I said, look, you were teaching this stuff. You know, you're teaching this. I said, you must have some idea. You're making these kind of statements. I said, you must have some idea. You give me. He says, well, 10,000. I said, well, I think that's a bit high even for the day. I said, I'll tell you how many there were. I said, there were 64. And the crime wave in London between 1925 and 1928 was the increase to 123 or whatever it was. That's an Open University said book. I was talking about complacency. Faith in the city was at least old-fashioned enough to list single fare and families as one of the six indicators of urban deprivation. Strange, given the general. How does that become urban deprivation if nobody believes it is deprivation? It's just as good as any other system and so forth. But anyways, listen, now the deprivation of unemployment is to be reduced. Overcrowding is to be reduced. Old people living alone are to be provided with opportunities for social contacts. But we read very little in Faith in the City about lone parenthood as a deprivation to be reduced. Though there are some passages that encourage that the number be increased. And shortly after it came out, I went to the Civic Centre at Sunderland to hear one of the commissioners. And the practical deduction that he'd drawn from all of this Faith in the City business was to remove the word family from family services on the notice board outside of his church, because it would upset some people that weren't married. By training, I do not mean the blunt instrument of formal lessons. That is ridiculous to suppose that if it hasn't been laid by experience from the moment the child is born, that it can be taught in our lectures or classes in the schools. That is an absurd sociological chimera. There are consequences which reach far beyond the child in the family without fatherhood. Only some boys today are children from father absent families. But all boys, all young men, without exception, whether they are 1 month old, or 10 years old, or 25 years old, face their future with progressively reduced social pressure or social training to become responsible and competent husbands and fathers. By training, I do not mean the blunt instrument of formal lessons. That is ridiculous to suppose that if it hasn't been laid by experience from the moment the child is born, that it can be taught in our lectures or classes in the schools. That is an absurd sociological chimera. Fatherhood is learned like a language. It is assimilated like one's native tongue, or it is not assimilated at all. It is transmitted through the countless messages of reinforcement and restriction that come every day from the moment of birth through parents, other kinsfolk, neighbours, and passing strangers. These messages embody, like one's native tongue, the common sense of generations, derived from the experience of ordinary people, as well as the contributions of geniuses, of what has proved benign and practicable in everyday life. The effects of the deinstitutionalization of the family on all young men Not only those raised in circumstances other than those of legitimacy in married parenthood is an issue of fundamental importance, yet has been addressed by hardly anyone. Far from the churches giving a lead in the exploration of the long-term consequences of, to use the current Kant term, postmodernism, those in the churches who have specialised in advocacy in matters of sex and child-rearing in recent years have pressed postmodernist social relationships not simply as a fact, which of course it is a fact, the growth of postmodernism, but as a prescription. Yet the effects of socially freeing young men from family responsibilities, deinstitutionalizing the family, and making sex, marriage, and parenthood the private affair of consenting adults, but not consenting offspring, has been an astonishing rise in the criminal behavior of young men. Again, crime fell. If you hear people saying, well, there was all this crime in the 19th century. There wasn't all of this crime in the 19th century. And crime fell in the 19th century. I'll perhaps put that on there. This is the crime rate for serious crimes, indictable offences, now called notifiable offences. Since figures were first collected, and of course, figures started to be collected in 1857, and by that time police forces were being set up, and then police forces were set up more and more. We were just coming by in 1850. One of the reasons the crime wasn't high was it was only in 1851 for the first time that urban district population exceeded rural district population. So most people were brought up under the old circumstances of village communities. And village communities can't stand a lot of villains, right? They don't stand a lot of villains. They know who the villains are. And starting with the horrors of the Industrial Revolution, 1860, the crime rate per 100,000 of the population was about 500. 500 crimes per 100,000 population. By the way, in those days, the crime rates used to be collected on the basis per million population. So that today, there's almost as many crimes committed in the West End of Newcastle upon Tyne than there were in the whole of the country 60 years ago. About 115,000 in the West End Police District of Newcastle upon Tyne, about 184,000 in the whole of the country. And that's you see it better from a diagram, that's the fall in the crime rate in the 19th century. As art galleries were provided, as the bylaw streets began to be built, as washhouses were provided, swimming baths and so on and so forth. When the working men got the vote in 1867 and the rural labour got the vote in 1844, local authorities as we roughly now know them in 1888, and people recognised that these things people were extremely, of course you can find alarm in the 19th century at the crime rate, because there was still crime. People couldn't understand that. I saw Bulldog Drummond the other night, the first Bulldog Drummond film. Ronald Coleman, 1929, I think. And Bulldog Drummond is called to this girl in distress who down at Godalming, who reckons that her father's been kidnapped and is being held against his will in this house in the neighbourhood. And Bulldog Drummond says, tell me another one. Those things don't happen in the British Isles. That's a film, and it's got to be plausible for the cinema audiences, hasn't it, in England? That could be a reasonable thing to do. The first Sherlock Holmes. So people, when people deny these, say these figures are rubbish, I say, well, let's look at other evidence then. The study in Scarlet, the first Sherlock Holmes story, when Watson comes on the scene and gets his digs with, and he says, what's the matter with you? And, you know, kind of zonked out like that. And he says, well, it's boring. Right? He says, there's no, you know, I'm a criminologist, he says, detective. He says, I'm a criminologist. He says, there's no crime in London. The first modern thriller was called The Riddle in the Sands. Erskine, he was finally t- stopped himself, wasn't he? They're on the boat in Germany, and there's some question about whether there's been an intruder on board. And the man that doesn't know so much, he says, I think it might have been a thief. He says, no, it's Germany, he says. Civilized country. The whole business about them being wrecked on the sands, he says, I can't understand that. Well, it can't be a government thing. No government would allow anybody to kill anybody else, and so on. So it fell in the 19th century. Now, but from a perspective, and you'll see for all the hoo-ha at any time about crime and about when crime was rising, great worry about rising crime. This is the period of the latchkey children. Great worry about this rise in crime, but if you go from the when the breakdown of the family begins in roughly 1955, then you'll see that just looks like a low and flat line. Because when you get to present day, take something like robbery, where there's again no dispute about the figure, right, that people are going to report, that's a serious crime. In any society, it's defined in much the same way over time. Robbery, that's taking what belongs to another, whatever the basis of belonging to another, by violence or threat of violence. The rise, that's the overall figure, but just the rise in robbery is about like that. The rise in robbery, the number of robberies, 1990 to 91, the rise, that figure there in a single year, was 2.5 times all cases of robbery in England and Wales in the entire interwar period. So something dramatic's happened to our society. Now, as the chairman said, this can't be attributed to, well, I put the unemployment, can't be attributed to rising unemployment as such. Can be attributed to rising unemployment if all the intellectuals begin to say, well, if you're unemployed, then the appropriate response is to riot or to steal or something. That's somehow an appropriate response. Then they do become linked. The definition of the situation has changed, and that begins to happen to a great degree. But the Archbishop of Canterbury, the first thing that he said about the Meadowell riots was bad housing, illiteracy. Bad housing, illiteracy, and unemployment. Well, I don't know. He certainly had not been at Meadowell. I mean, tree-lined avenues, right? Built by local architects and several times renewed. And what's bad housing? I mean, it's bad housing to an extent in that some of the streets don't have any slates on the roofs because you can get 25p for a slate. but nobody's having to live in those houses. That is, they're rehoused from those houses. There's the unemployment rates. So I've shown you this. Just get the picture of the crime rates again for a moment. And there's the unemployment rates. The average unemployment in Sunderland between 1928 and 1934 was 34%. The average male unemployment was 34%. There's no comparison between the crime rate in 1934 and today. Unemployment was much worse, so it's a matter of how people, what moral judgments people are making upon factual circumstances. That is what has crucially changed are the moral judgments that are being made about factual circumstances, not the factual circumstances themselves. I'm a member of the Labour Party and I'm chairman of the local Fabians, and I'm against inequality and I'm against poverty and I'm against all, but I say that those are problems on their own. They're not the problems. If you solve those, you're going to solve the problem of crime. That's a separate issue. And the cause of the increase in crime is the decoupling young men from some kind of fundamental meaning of life to which ordinary paid employment is merely an adjunct. Do you think that my wife's father went down the pit from the age of 12? He was a clever boy, so he was able to leave school at 12 in those days. If you were clever, you would leave school early to go to work. He's not, by the way, he's not, this is not ancient history, this is my father-in-law. And he went down with his tin of cold tea and his jam sandwich. He ate it down the pit, right, with being careful that the other men's excreta didn't get on his hands as he sat down, right? Until he was 65, do you think he did that for himself? He did it because it was within the context, and the meaning of that work was the meaning of his family life. Today's tragedy is that those few in the church who have taken it upon themselves to be the modern experts on the family, influential out of all proportion to their numbers, instead of being a bulwark against these forces of deconstruction, have in large part deserted the ramparts and are storming them with the enemy.
Thank you very much indeed for that. As I said at the beginning, Norman Dennis is prepared now to take comments and questions. So, yes.
I would like to ask, people would say it was unloving, but I wonder whether self-control would come back all night if people knew there was no money forthcoming whatsoever for maternity, all for the child.
How would you respond to that?
Well, I just respond to it, it's just impossible to do. And I would obviously, I'm quite pessimistic.
If you wouldn't mind, yes, please.
I'm quite pessimistic about the future. The chairman, I was surprised at how well it sounded when you said they can easily destroy what it passes their wit to create. I think culture can be easily destroyed. Culture is a very, very fragile and hard one thing. And I mean, what's happened is that that people, of course, have had a tremendous lever, haven't they, to move opinion. Because what they've said is that really, well, it's not the baby's fault. Can't harm the baby because of this. The very fact, the more that, in fact, the I don't often have this argument, but it's obviously an argument we've heard. The more that you can show that these children are disadvantaged, the more public funds you've got to put in to see that their disadvantage that they've got nothing to do with is corrected. So I don't think that there's any question of saying, well, we're going to do it with money. I don't know how it is done, by the way. Well, I'll tell you this, that a couple of years ago, it was very, very difficult for me to say what I say. I've been saying this for quite a long time, but the last chapter of Rising Crime and Dismembered Family, I call the sea change in public opinion. That public opinion has been beginning. The people just run into these facts, right, and they've got bloody noses, and they're realising that they can't talk rubbish anymore. But a couple of years ago, I was having a lot of difficulty. And I was talking about this with my daughter down at Binfield near Bracknell there. And she said, what are you going to do about it, Dad? And I said, well, look, I go into the North Sea for a swim, I said, you know. I raise the temperature of the North Sea, but I'm not very optimistic about what, you know, what good that's going to do with a kid swimming, you know, swimming in Dieppe. I said, well, I don't know. I mean, that what can one person do? And all you can do is keep plugging away and say what you've got to say. And I mean, I'm invited here, so some people might read the books or something. I hate it, or it's all, I mean, you just say, well, we'll see what kind of effect it has. But anyway, 2 years ago, when it was very difficult to talk about these kind of things, and you were really held down and treated with I mean, I had a very hard time in the department, actually, when talking about sociologists, social policy people generally. Very unusual to find people that are very hostile to the evil Norman Bennett. And anyway, I picked up the, she went to bed, and it was about 1:15 in the morning, I picked up the Times, and I saw this article, and it said something about one-parent family as good as a two-parent family. It's the feature. The news report, actually, I thought, oh, right. And it, just as I was pushing the way, I saw my name there. Now, I told you that I had a very bad time in London, and that's when I came back, and my friend had said, doesn't need a professor to say that. And I said, I'd never go to London again, I more kicks than halfpence. And so anyway, I was rather tricked into giving another paper, and I then said I'd prepare the paper, I wouldn't give it. But I said that he could give it or what. Anyway, it was finally given by A.H. Halsey, in fact, he wrote the introduction to my book. And this Times report said that Halsey was given my paper, right? And it caused a sensation, electrified the conference and so forth. But this other academic, Norman Dennis, shows that the one-parent family is as good as the two-parent family. Because in the paper, of course, I'd made the point about the overlapping distributions. So this report got all mixed up, but it somehow, and that's the headline of the Times, by the way. Okay. Now, from that time, I got back, and there was a big hoo-ha in the Guardian, and from that time, I can only say that things completely changed, and I've been to Zurich and Dublin and Budapest, and in my old age, my wife suddenly finds that I'm not at home very much. She's not very happy there waiting for me to get the overnight bus to Gatwick now. She thinks I ought to be in Florida already. But it shows that the public opinion. I said to my daughter at the time, I said, it's a strange business, Julia. Right? You never know what's going to happen. Right? Nobody can say, right? And perhaps the same old thing will just grind away, and no society can survive. One of the great favourites of my colleagues is Jean-Jacques Rousseau, right? And the social contract and so forth. And I was just glancing through the social contract the other day, and I came across this passage from Rousseau. He says, whoever gets control of marriage controls the state. Right? Mm. But earlier he also says that the family is the basic cell of any society and so on and so forth. And there's no society. Oh, Rousseau wasn't aware of political correctitude at the time. So what the passage says is actually that no society can succeed when it is composed of bastards. There's not the possibility of people learning in that small group from the very earliest moment, and the same people, right, handling problems in its presence, right, becoming gradually conscious of how these problems are handled, right, whole pressure of the society saying, look, you've got to handle those problems. You get no prestige unless you can handle those problems. In the book I quote, I think, may I quote this book, right? There's an excellent example here. If I can quickly turn myself to it. So I was reading a social studies journal, and Peter Morris is reviewing a book called The Classic Slum by Robert Roberts. That's a very well-known book, and I knew the book very well anyway. And I saw that Morris was reviewing it. A Cambridge intellectual, not one of these petty people out in the sticks, you know, teaching at Provincial University at Newcastle. Well, that is the fact of the case. I'm not being funny, that is the fact of the case. And who's going to be listened to? I think I say elsewhere in the book that there's never the question about who's talking rubbish. There's always people talking rubbish. The question is, who is handed the microphone? Right? Who is given the microphone? Who is given the pages of the intellectual journals? Who is invited onto the discussion programmes of the BBC? Who makes the entertainment programmes to get across this or that message? The question is, who's handed the megaphone? And if you're in Cambridge, you've got access to the megaphone than if you're in Newcastle. And then you have Peter Morris. Robert Roberts shows that, quote, fathers were petty tyrants, remote and harsh. Well, I say, it's rather funny, this actually. I say, this seems to be independent of what Roberts actually wrote. This is what Roberts wrote. One or two proletarian authors, or even worse, of course, pseudo-proletarian authors at Cambridge, writing about these times and of the slump between the wars, by depicting its cruder and more moronic members, end by caricaturing the class as a whole. Most men, even in the slum, Roberts says explicitly, he says even in the slum, right? He's not saying even in Millfield in Sunderland, or even in Hendon in Sunderland, right? Not in the widespread, respectable working class parts of the town. He says, even in the slum, were not boors and not drunken braggarts. People en masse, it is true, I'm reading now Roberts, people en masse, it is true, had little education. But the discerning of the time saw abundant evidence of intelligence, shrewdness, restraint and maturity. Of course there were low characters by the score, funny and revolting. So did every slum in Britain. Such types set no standards. In sobriety they knew their place well enough. Very many families, even in our law district, remained awesomely respectable over a lifetime. Despite poverty and appalling surroundings, parents brought up their children to be decent, kindly and honourable, and often lived long enough to see them occupy a higher place socially than they'd ever known themselves, the greatest satisfaction of all. It is such people and their children who now deny indignantly, and I believe rightly, that the slum life of the industrial law, the North in this century, for all its horrors, was ever so mindless and uncouth, a superficial play or novel would have a later generation believe. Homes, however poor, were the focus of all the boys' love and interests. Songs about its beauties were ever on people's lips. Home Sweet Home, first heard in the 1870s, had become almost a second national anthem. Few walls in lower working class homes lacked mottos attesting to domestic joys. East West Home's best. Bless our home. God is master of this house. Home is the nest where all is best. To hear of a teenager leaving or being turned out of this home struck dark fear into a child's mind. He could hardly imagine a fate more awful. So anyway, the answer to the question is that I don't think it's on.
It's Brian.
Are you implying by that last quotation that commitment to fatherhood is greater in the working class communities?
No.
Are there figures to show that varies in social classes?
Well, I'll say what I think is the important point bearing on your question first. I think the important point is that the family has largely been dismantled by people whose circumstances made it reasonable for them personally to dismantle the family. That is, in terms of their personal interests, that they could lead a good life by not being tied to another adult for a long time and by making arrangements for their own children. That is, the people that were better educated, the people that had more income, that they can handle the non-family situation, the deinstitutionalized treatment of sex and children fairly effectively. At any level in the social class system, the married family does better than the unmarried family. But it doesn't really show all that much. There's lots of padding and, you can get on the board of Barings Bank and look like a banker, right? And nobody's kind of in a position to say that you're not, okay? Because there's doesn't make all the difference if you're stupid. Well, I shouldn't have mentioned Barings Bank. I just mean that is simply the case. What's happened in the last 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, right, what's happened is that those people happen to have stumbled, well, part of their experience is this new medium, the way of getting their message into every household. Right? And they have, the family in the working class is in ruins. The working class children, you go around places like Hetherly Hall or Horton, right, which were absolutely wonderful places once upon a time, wonderful communities, and you'll find that the lads are on the rampage, worse there than anywhere else. So there's no question of somehow the working class having survived this attack. That's my argument with Charles Murray, the famous proponent of the notion of the underclass. I say, look, it's not the underclasses, in inverted commas, fault, right? Underclasses don't create culture. Underclasses don't destroy culture. That's created and destroyed by people who have responsibility for culture, by Archbishop of Canterbury, and by prime ministers, and by ministers of the crown, by vicars, the sub-intelligentsia, so to speak, like me, petty teachers in universities just having a few students through, or a few people through the congregation, right? The sub-intelligent, you know, not the Baxters or the Bunyans or anything, but just ordinary, right? And in the bureaucracies now, well, look at what's happened. Whenever you get anything from the UN, well, I'll tell you this. The just before the UN Year of the Family was going to take place, I was at a seminar in the Department of Social Policy, and the man that came, who runs, a professor that runs a family centre in some southern place, he thought that he was among friends. So he was bragging and prating and prancing around and how clever he was and how clever his pals were that they'd got into the European community, right? That they were the ones that were affecting all a few bureaucrats that are going to get the ear of whoever's going to, right? Right? And they'd actually got this definition for the UN Year of the Family. That the family is any group of, he says, well, see, wonderful, you see. The German constitution that guarantees the protection of the family, right? And the Irish constitution that guarantees the, can you see the beauty of it? Right? That if the family is defined as a homosexual couple who have adopted a kid or something, okay, then the German constitution protecting the family has now got to protect them, the original intention. And he was bragging about the way in which this works in modern bureaucratic structures. And of course that's clearly happened in the Church of England, that most people didn't think that anything was happening for years and years and years. Nobody knew what was happening. They wake up one morning and they find that the people that have had an interest in sexuality, have had an interest in lone parenthood, have had an interest in having these things equalised, And the public is completely confused by it. I'll just give you this example. Don't take that I've got any particular view. In fact, I've been in trouble before by saying that that I don't care really about homosexuals. Right? I mean, if they want to get on with it, then get on with it. But don't try to universalise it. Right? And some people said, well, that's the wrong attitude towards it. But I genuinely am a liberal on that question. I see that Cardinal Hume's joined me on that now. But just to illustrate the way in which, how far this has gone. Can you remember last year, there was a bit of a row about that television, illustratively, the television producer who had a student on part-time work, and they fell in love with one another. Two males, that's the point of the story. And they had a candlelit marriage service in the old news, the Tyneside cinema there. Can remember that issue? Liverpool, Rawlins Guild. And anyway, some MP, homophobic MP, start to play war about the fact that they were getting honeymoon leave and a wedding present and so forth from the BBC. Really on the grounds that it's not public, the public's not interested in marriages that have no chance of having children. The public's interested in marriages and encouraging marriages and encouraging stable marriages if there's going to be children, because that's important, that's a socially important thing. But of course there was a great row about it. And then I read in the Daily Telegraph that the BBC had to back down, that this MP had won, whoever he was. Well, the MP hadn't won, and the BBC hadn't backed down. Because the issue was, is heterosexual marriage as publicly important as homosexual marriage? Is it worthy of as much social honour? And what the BBC did was to say, well, if the homosexuals can't have it, then the heterosexuals can't have it. And they kept the equivalence between homosexual marriage and heterosexual marriage.
Mark.
When you watch influential programmes, for example, The Word, there's a great atmosphere of celebration, particularly about sex. Have we allowed this in by default, by not promoting positive celebratory images of the family? How can we reverse that?
Well, you see, people that want to celebrate their own person, in my view, that's not a problem, so to speak. Right? I think that it's given that I'm very conscious of my wife waiting for me in Sunderland now, right? But I'm not all that worried about it. You understand me? She wonders whether I'm going to get packed in time. All this kind of thing. And she wonders whether I'm going to put in some two or three workman's winter shirts, like for Florida. Right? So she's sitting, and I'm worried, and I realise she's worried, and I want to do something about it. Right? But I'm not all that worried about it. I love my children, Julia had a toothache, right? It's terrible. It's terrible. It didn't hurt me nearly as much as my toothache. Right? Do you understand? Right? I mean, that's just the fact. That people's own interests always loom large, and therefore all the social work has to go in to altruism. Well, I mean, there is a basis in human nature, of course, for altruism. There's the human material there for it, and there's all kinds of things that make it possible. And there is no doubt, genetically, at least let's say, it's easy to postulate, I'll put it that way, that in the course of evolution, human beings have done well because they have got inbuilt sociability. But the job is to stop people allowing their own interests to loom as large as they really do loom and inevitably loom in their own life. So once it's away and free, it's very difficult to get back there. I mean, there's not many societies that have become civilized on the scale that we've become civilized, this 50 million people, right, in one way or another, producing endless Mars bars out of Slough, endless hamburgers out of Killingworth, right? You know, whenever you see these things, absolutely astonished. A cousin of mine, I was at a party at the Willow Pond on Friday, and a cousin of mine's working at the Soucard works he's a heating and ventilation engineer. He's putting in the hot water pipes for the hot chocolate. And they actually heat up these enormous tankers in these sheds, right? They've got some heating coils in these tankers. They put liquid chocolate in, and the drivers have got 6 hours to deliver it to somewhere in Belgium. Right? Now, I mean, there's not many societies can work that trick. The very great English philosopher Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan, said that unless you've got people that can cooperate, right, and that's the difference. That people are equal, he said, right? I mean, people are equal because they can equally screw one another up, right? And eventually they can kill one another, right? The weakest person, he says, can kill the strongest person, either by himself or with confederates. And he says, unless you get some way of building this culture of cooperation, and you build this culture of cooperation through taking these strange invaders, right? These babies that come into the world, right? And getting them to be capable of producing their own keep at whatever standard in whatever society, and producing a surplus for people that can't, or won't, for that matter. You see, so the people that won't, still got to produce a surplus for them. And if you're not producing it, that's a difficult job to produce that. And Thomas Hobbes says, if you don't do that, he says there'll be no commodious buildings, no navigation of the sea, no cultivation of the soil, because no one will be certain of the fruits thereof. Now, you see that already on places like Pennywell, that my relations say, I'm not going to get a video recorder, I'll be out of the house the next day. So there'll be no equivalent of the cultivation of the soil. And what is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of man solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, right? All hinging on this solitary business. Now, this celebration of postmodernism is the celebration of atomistic relationships, of non-committed relationships, of no past, no future, only the present, only your own body. I watched a television program a few months ago now. You know the date when I tell you the story. But it was a television program about Michel Foucault. And I go around the universe, you can't hear anybody talk about Michel Foucault. But it's all the sadism, right? And the celebration of, you know, all you've got is your body and your feelings, okay? And the most powerful feelings are your sexual feelings, and really, let's face it, right? Heterosexuality is a pretty messy business, right? Having to do with another person of the opposite sex. It's much more convenient to find some other way. Do it yourself probably is the best way, right? It's all Foucault, right? And this is all being glorified on this Channel 4 program in the week that minister had been found with the woman's stockings and the tangerine in his mouth, right? Applying the Foucault principles to his own enjoyment. But that is so. I think we're in a serious state in our society when intellectuals are preaching this kind of doctrine of self-fulfillment, of atomism, of temporary relationships, of independence, of self-fulfillment, I don't know if I've said that already, and so on and so forth. Because no society can last very long on that basis.
I'll have to do one last, I'm conscious of your wife waiting for you in Sunderland. I think he is. He ought to be. One last question, David.
I'm more worried than the average fellow.
One last question, David.
I've been married 41 years, and there's not many people who can say it. Never a harsh word, there you are.
David.
You're going to America tomorrow. Well, I had the privilege of being there just a fortnight ago. And I was quite amazed at what has happened there. And, you know, in some ways, what happens there sometimes happens here. Can I just illustrate it? I picked up on the airport, Time magazine. I get it in this country. And on the 27th of February, it's quite interesting. I mean, that is the Time magazine for the 27th of February, which is for better, for worse. And the cover story is the growing movement to strengthen marriage and prevent divorce in America. And I thought, I'll buy it, just in case we don't have the same thing in this country. And, of course, that's the one for Europe, which is all about films and, you know, something quite irrelevant. Now, it is quite interesting that, I mean, it's interesting, but there has been a sea change, and all this whole Republican thing is not right-wing politics. It's fundamentally on these sort of issues. And what's happened, I mean, what I've picked up is, I mean, people have stopped being passive. The people who aren't these separated intellectuals or whatever you call them, they've actually done something. Have you any comment on this? Because, I mean, we are passive in this country. I mean, we tolerate the Archbishops of Canterbury when they talk like this. I mean, some of us don't, but I mean, it's... it is, generally speaking, you know, we are passive, all of us. And we tolerate the BBC, we tolerate these people on Channel 4. But in America, there's been a radical change. Have you any comments on this?
Yes. Well, I'm going to Florida, and I'm going to see my son, who... my wife will tell you that he was brought up on the very best principles, and I turned him out to be the model citizen, father, husband, nephew, of 1935. And so he found it very uncomfortable in England, and he went off to really the southern United States. And in the southern United States, we can see some developments now of television, where as the society does become rich enough, then instead of everybody being fed by this from only one source, you've got this splitting out of television channels, and people can now again in a position to preserve their own culture and propagate their own culture a bit more effectively. So in the southern United States, I do see that I've seen these movements, and I do get I generally get the National Review, so I'm pretty well up on American, inverted commas, right-wing politics. As I say, the final chapter of Rising Crown and the Dismembered Family is called The Sea Change in Public Opinion, and things have changed, and I think that so to speak, facts are eventually pretty formidable things. But at the same time, our little episode of Gingrich Republicanism, so to speak, our little episode was when Clark and Lilly and Major all got this, Portillo, Howard, all got this idea that this was that in fact people were interested in the family.